All right. So today we have Bethany McKinney Blunt. Thanks so much for joining today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
All right. So the topic of discussion is fostering growth and career pathing within engineering first organizations. So if you could maybe give us an idea about the arc of your career, what did that look like from the early days?
So I took a very non-traditional path into engineering in general, though I think coming up through infrastructure and ops, and particularly as a sysad, that's actually more common in that section of engineering focus. I started out working doing print and packaging design in production, not engineering at all. And for a print company back in Texas, this would have been in the 90s. And then I was working on second shift. So you would end up working second or third shift to get stuff sent out overnight. And the there was a small team that supported, a small technology team that supported all of this work going through. And at the time we had, we were doing very, very large files. They were hundreds of megs of files, right? What we would do is you'd have problems getting them converted. You have file problems, you have system problems, you have network problems. And I'd end up having to call these guys up in the middle of the night, like, you know, 11 o'clock at night, 1 in the morning. And tell them something was broken because they needed to fix it. And after a while, it just got easier for me to figure out how to fix a lot of those things on my own. So I figured out how to troubleshoot the rips, how to figure out files. One day, I walked into the president of the company's office and said, hey, so I'm not going to do my job I've been doing anymore. I'm going to go work with these other guys. I had not told anyone this. I had not told my boss this. I had not told the guys I was going to go, I wanted to go work with. I had not told anyone. It did cause a little bit of a stir, but we eventually got that, and I actually got to do that. So then I spent several years there, working as essentially a sysad, and then doing some back-end integration work, really. The biggest project I ended up doing there was I built a high availability print and file server for the National Enquirer, before I was done there, which is all on like SGI failsafe and, so many. I could field strip an origin 2000. That's pretty much what I could do. It's just like strange things that you end up doing in those jobs. Nice. Lots of pulling wires. But then I had an offer to come to California and work in what in retrospect was a product role, but we didn't really call it that at the time, because one of the software companies that I worked with very closely who specialized in our industry didn't have anybody inside, had very few people inside the company who had ever worked in the industry. So I wanted someone who actually knew how to use the product, not just make the product. So I came out to Berkeley, worked with them for a few years. Print is dying. I don't think that's a big shock. It was, you know, not a growth industry. So when I was recruited out of that company to go work at Second Life, I thought, this is the weirdest company I've ever seen, and it's either going to take over the world or explode spectacularly. And either way, I kind of want to be inside. So I went to Second Life. So I basically went from being on call for 8 years, basically doing print sysad work, to doing product work at a very, very slow pace at the Berkeley company, back into something that was a lot faster, where we had availability needs and things like that when I went over to Second Life.
Yeah.
And while I was there, I started out working with the ops team, sort of going back to my, going to my roots as an infrastructure person, but I wasn't doing ops engineering work anymore. I was very much I was sort of the glue between that team and the rest of the company, just in having conversations, because while that team was incredibly talented, there were sometimes, like in many engineering orgs, frustrations where the priorities weren't being clearly communicated. The needs of the team that were executing weren't necessarily being understood by the people who were depending upon them. So that was what I started out doing. And in my tenure at Second Life, a lot of stuff changed there. Things moved pretty fast in the company that stage. I went from starting out working with just the ops team to eventually working with the web team. And then by the time I left, I was an engineering director with everybody who was related to the front end of the system, or anything where an external person interacted with the system. Those teams all rolled up to me. So that was the website, all of the money, the financial index, the economy that they had, all of the viewer stuff, all of the APIs, all of those things. I left Second Life under some difficulty. I would say there was a lot of changes in that company, and I did not get on with the new CEO. That's sort of a nice understatement. I then took a pass through EMI Music, which I was the VP of software engineering there. We were doing a startup equivalent inside a big company. It's like a little baby. This is really common, right? Where they have the lab or whatever that's doing the small tech thing going on inside the big enterprise organization. I think that, at least in this case, I don't think it worked very well. I think that we shipped some really good product out of that team, but I don't think that the organization really understood what it meant to support software products, which I think is pretty common. And so that was the worst job I've ever had. So then I left there and started a company, a small startup company called MailRank. We built email productivity software and were pretty much completely undermined by the release of Google Priority Inbox partway through our 10-year run. So we were fortunate to join. We sold our company to Facebook towards about 6 months before, 4 or 5 months before the IPO. I worked there for several years on really complicated infrastructure projects. So things around data centers and capacity and security and disaster recovery. That was one of my favorites. Yeah. Big things that'll kill the company if you don't figure them out. You know, that's always my favorite thing. That was my tenure there. I worked basically in the group there called production engineering, which is similar in difficult in execution, but similar in intent, I think, of problem solving, of what a lot of companies use for SRE. They're not exactly interchangeable, but they're kind of similar. And that was a relatively large team and a bunch of managers that I had inside that org before I went to be the VP of engineering at Reddit, which lasted 1 month. Started afterwards, became one of the founding advisors of Project Include, and then founded the company I have now. So it's interesting how you take this sort of strange journey through companies doing different kinds of roles, I think, to end up being a startup founder again, which is not what I thought I was going to do at all. So what's interesting about the problems about doing things like disaster recovery inside a company is that it's really, I find, like a twofold problem. The first problem is the problem of risk and being willing to confront risk and look at risk and identify risk. That is one of the facets of it. But candidly, one of the other problems is just being afraid to even try to wrap your arms around something that's so amorphous and complicated. Because even if you can look at your company and say, or your product or whatever, and say, we have this risk here, this is a risk. You can say it, you can say words. The moment where you go, oh, we need to do something about that risk. We need to do something. Like, you know, you put your hands up in the air, like, that was always my favorite part of doing any of the project. That was one of the things that brought me to Reddit early on, is there were a lot of problems with a lot of challenges that fell into that category. That was one of my favorite things that I got to do at Facebook, was just, if it was a problem that was so gnarly and amorphous but going to kill the company, like, that for me was my sweet spot.
where you
have to take this giant thing, you know, and break it into, okay, let's decide what we are doing, let's decide what we are explicitly not doing,
right?
And yes, we know that if there's a super volcano that we aren't solving for that problem, fine, we're choosing alien invasion. We had Godzilla actually on one of the slides that we went around internally with. We said we are not solving for Godzilla. We are not solving for aliens. We are not solving for meteor strikes. We're solving for hurricanes first. You know, that was sort of, you have to like prioritize at some point. And for me, you know, doing that work of whittling something down to the first version of something so that you get that traction is always a big part of how you face down a risk anyway. Because yes, you can identify it and go, oh no, we're vulnerable in any facet, right? But doing the analysis, and it's that interesting combination of like of data and intuition that you sort of have to put together, and then pragmatism.
Yeah.
And then say, I propose that this is the first thing we do to reduce this risk. And then getting buy-in for that. That was always, those were always my favorite parts of any of the things I've done in any of those companies. There were always some versions of that.
So yeah, it's funny. Whenever I've been in those situations, it's usually a whiteboard with a flow chart for execs. And it's like, you want to focus on the parts that go to end, we're out of business, or at least in a big company like Facebook, they're not going to go out of business, but can they really sustain a one day outage, right? What does that do to your morale or the customer base, you know? So you're not going to go out of business, but you're going to piss a lot of people off, you know? So,
and then how do you recover from that? And if you go down, can you come back? Like, that's the, my other favorite one was, if your system goes down, regardless of what the system is, how do you bring it back up? Like, sometimes people haven't even figured that out.
Yeah, actually, a funny story from one of the other folks in this series that I talked to. They're old school, right? They're at UT Arlington, and they claim to have been there during when they rebooted the internet from the Morris worm, actually. So they actually had to reboot the whole internet. That was the last time I think all the computers that were online rebooted simultaneously, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, how do you bring it up, huh?
Yeah, how do you do that? That was the, I mean, I've done that exercise at various companies for various versions of bringing whatever it is back up. And sometimes it's easy, but sometimes it's really not.
Yeah, totally. So if you could talk about what you're doing with your current company, what's the focus of your current company?
So my current company is called Compass. We do compensation as a service. So comp as a service. Our company, we are an HR tech company, and we're a platform where we help companies make better decisions about how they're paying their employees, and also get better insight into how they're managing their biggest operational expense. Most companies are in the people employment business, right? When we look at how we spend our money. But it's pretty complicated. It's way more complicated than I would have expected when we first started working on this too. Actually understand what you're doing with all of that. It's the most complicated stuff we do from a technology perspective right now is integration with a bunch of heterogeneous systems. But my co-founder is completely amazing, so that takes the edge off of that one for me. We're really passionate about this because we want companies, I think everybody wants to make good decisions, but it's not always obvious what is a good decision. We want to make it easier for companies to have the information in front of them so they can make the best choices about how to be awesome. I mean, companies are made of people. So how do you help your people, right?
Yeah, definitely. Great. So you went over your career history kind of in broad strokes, but maybe along the way, could you talk about some of the people that really believed in you, or the people that gave you a big chance, or maybe where your defining moments of growth were in your own, you know, period there?
Oh, that's such a good question. There are a few things that, looking back, I realize were more key than I realized at the time. There was when I was a sysad, actually I was very traditional sysad too, right? Like, the only thing I was missing was like the neck beard. Like, I mean, I had the whole thing. Like, I was very, very traditionally sysad. Like, you picture like the guy with six monitors, like very, you know, 80s movie guy in the six monitors in the dark, you know, leaning back with terrible posture. Like, this was totally me trogging through stuff. And I would get so ferociously angry sometimes because I would be unable to get something done that I felt like we needed to do. And I was lucky in that company because in that printing company that because it was complicated enough that it was interesting. We had a lot of different locations and some complicated technology challenges, but it was also understaffed enough that I had a lot of latitude in how to do my job. There is flexibility that comes with understaffing, though I don't generally celebrate it. I remember having a conversation with a woman who I didn't work for, but she was one of my internal customers. I was supporting her. She was completely badass and still is completely badass. And she helped run the production teams, like the ones who are actually making the packages and making the print ads and things like that. And I had been telling her how disappointed, I used way more colorful language than this, I'm certain, But I was very disappointed with the quality of management that I'd been exposed to at that company. She was probably one of the only managers in that company that I felt was doing a very good job. And I said, I will never do this. I will never do this job. I will never be a manager. I will never be one of these guys. I don't like the way they do this. I don't see the point of them. You know, very standard, you know, sassy early 20s person in their career. And she looked at me really, really kindly. And she said to me, she said, someday you're going to want to do a project that's bigger than you can do yourself. And you're going to want that project done more than you're going to want to hold to this decision you're making today about never being a manager. She's like, someday you're going to want to get the stuff done more than you're going to want to not be a manager. And she says, and when that happens, you're going to discover that helping people do a thing means more to you than doing the thing yourself.
Yeah. Awesome.
And I thought she was full of it, by the way. I was like, no way. But you know,
yeah,
she was totally right.
Well, that she's totally right. That's nice. That keys into a big part of this whole series where we're talking about multiplier effects, and we'll get into it today mm-hmm. as well. It's like in aligning the individual's growth with the org, you know, what kind of multipliers can you get out of that? In fact, mm-hmm. that's a good segue. Why don't we talk about that? I mean, yeah. So what do you do to keep your staff, you know, on a continuous learning, continuous improvement path where they're always challenged, and ideally the effects of that have a multiplier in your org? Mm-hmm.
It is funny. So we are a very small company right now. We're fewer than 10 people. So that's trivially easy to do where we are right now, because there is always more stuff to do than we can do. And there's lots of opportunity for people to stretch out and try other things. But in other larger, more structured, more narrow scoped role organizations, which is a normal path for companies to go down, I think that one of the biggest challenges that you need to, the biggest opportunities that you have to overcome this is just to be deliberate about it in the first place. As a manager, thinking about how you're going to create opportunities for growth is something that can often get lost in the day-to-day doing the work. And remembering that, I fundamentally believe, and this is like this is my number one most core belief about being a manager. I believe that it is our responsibility as a manager to imagine a more badass version of every person we work with.
Yeah, nice.
and it's also our responsibility as a manager to help them move towards that more badassery. And so because this is like one of my defining fundamental principles as a manager and a leader, it's always in the front of my mind. But I recognize that in the moment, in the heat of trying to get stuff shipped and get stuff done, it's easy to lose. So at a minimum, if it's not something where you're wired for it, building a cadence where you remember as a manager that part of your, like I, early on before I found a sort of an easier sense of the flow of the work, I would actually, and when I change roles, I still do this. I like will put calendar events on my system to remember, like,
oh, yeah,
this is where I'm going to spend time to think about this very deliberately, because otherwise you'll get lost. It'll get lost.
Yeah. That's a huge life hack. A standing calendar with things you should be doing.
Yes.
That saved my life 4 or 5 years ago. Started doing that then.
Yeah. That, and then the other one with that, I mean, as long as we're talking about like manager life hacks or just role change life hacks, is the one where you keep a log of everything you're doing in a day. For, you know, just keep it running in a notebook for a while, because one of the things that I find happens, not just with me, but with everybody I've ever worked with, is when you change a role from, say, being an IC to a manager in particular, you aren't committing code like you were, right? Like you don't get that feedback. And so you get through the end of the day and you're like, I didn't do anything all day. Like, why am I so tired? I haven't done anything all day. I've done nothing all day, because you didn't have like the nice log of commits or whatever it is. I had that problem when I moved out of doing packaging design work into being a sysad, because I wasn't making anything all day. So I didn't feel like I was doing anything. So I go through this like pretty much every new job. So keeping that log of all the things that you do can help you both decide if you're doing the right things and also remind yourself why you're so tired. It's not that you did something wrong.
Nice. Those are great hacks. I like it. Okay, so throughout that path that you just explained, at some point you went from being an individual contributor to an engineering manager, where you finally had, you know, a group of peers that you're responsible for. So what I'm looking for there is, you know, what kind of new skills, what kind of challenges did you have taking on this new type of role?
I made that path. I'd been sort of a team lead and an informal team lead and things like that up to that point in various companies. So I'd had at least, you know, you'd get some of the project blocking and tackling and some of the touching base with people blocking and tackling. I'd had some of that experience.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I was at Second Life that I had the official transition, which is a really weird place to have done it. Hmm. Because Second Life did not have managers when I got there. That was their thing. They just didn't have them. It was a sort of a holacracy precursor kind of company.
Right. Flat org.
There were a lot of, I mean, I admit, I know there are lots of people who love the flat org, but having lived through the miasma of the middle of a flat org, I think they work really well for the people who don't want to do the management job mostly. And I'm not saying all of them are work this way, but I just see a lot of people who say, oh, we do this because it empowers everybody. I'm like, you do it because you don't want to do management work, because work, that's really hard work. So what happened in Second Life, I think, was actually that in retrospect. There was a position of like everyone would choose their own work. That was the Dow of London, choose your own work. And that led to weird things, and we weren't shipping like we should. It was hard to do things. And also, as an individual person inside that company, it was really uncomfortable. Like, you'd be dropped into the middle of the ocean with like not even a compass and say, like, choose what you're going to do. And having someone sort of like look out for you at least and give you support and help you get feedback on how you were doing was something that most people inside the company were really craving. There was the first thing that happened with me was I was helping support the ops team. I was definitely not their manager. I was working with that team. When I went to go work with the web team, there was not long after I joined, there was a guy who left. Like, he left to go do something else. And there was this gap there with the web team. And I was their substitute teacher for a while. Like, I was hopping in to like help out while they were recruiting to replace that person. And then I think at the time he was still head of engineering, might have been CTO, came to me and said, you should run the web team. And I was like, I don't want to run the team. I don't want to be a manager. And he's like, no, you should totally do it. And he absolutely ran a very good convincing thing on me where he said, well, you know, you aren't going to be happy with how anyone else does it. And I was stuck then because he was right. That was my first team that I was directly managing to some extent. It was the first team where I had some sort of direct influence over what we were doing, how we were doing it. Second Life had a very, I don't even think they called me a manager because we didn't do that. We'd broken the company into what we called studios. And then you would have like, people could choose to join and leave studios. It was very fluid. It was a very strange company. But I would say that there was some organizational changes in the executive team. And when that happened, a few of the people who had been doing engineering leadership essentially got together with the VP of engineering, who Joe Miller, who died several years ago and I miss all the time. He was so wonderful. But Joe and a few of us were together and we basically designed the first real organizational structure for Second Life Engineering. And that was when we started doing real managers for the first time. So real managers would be both in a place where they could influence what somebody was working on and had the responsibility of doing things like supporting someone, supporting their career. So I went from being, I don't know, almost like a consulting manager, like roaming consulting manager, to having, you'd have mentor, you'd be a mentor, which was sort of like the people part of management, but only sometimes. But to having a more traditional, but still not very aggro management structure. And that's when I started working with all the front end teams. Like, I had all the front end teams at that point because of that redo. And we did that. Then I was managing managers for the first time, like directly managing managers for their success as a manager. Some of them all of them? All of them were first-time managers. Oh my goodness, that's right. I would say there was a lot of learning on the job going on for everyone at that moment. But it was still still generally a good move. I don't remember if I had any direct reports at that time. I think maybe I only had managers rolling up to me, which makes sense because, you know, managing managers and managing individual contributors is such a completely different job. And I find, you know what I mean? Like you have, there is this this wonderful naivete that people have with the first time they're going to start managing managers, because they're like, I've been a manager, so I know how to manage them. And no, you don't. I mean, it's just a completely different job. What you focus on, what you prioritize, how you support them for both their growth and how you support them to do the job of growing others. It's different. The cadence of the work is different. I like to do 2 meetings a week with managing managers, like per, instead of just like 1 for my regular one-on-ones, at least for a while, because you want to have some meetings that are about that person as a human and how they're developing, and then some that are about supporting them in their execution of their work while they're supporting people down in their teams.
100%.
And it's like you just have to be really, it's a lot easier to manage ICs, man. The managing up is different too, right? So I don't have very much managing up right now. But certainly, like, I think it's the responsibility of all managers to manage up. Something else I learned really, I guess, more at Second Life than I'd realized in the past. But not just manage up. You're not managing up necessarily for yourself. You're managing up for the defense and support of your team. Because if there isn't good understanding of what they're doing, what the value is they're bringing, then they are subject to seagull effects from the manager above you, right? So being proactive in those communications and those support and context setting, explanation, prioritization, and those things, managing up is really important to help your team be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is actually a fun one, because normally I have these questions hardwired, but this org is a little bit
unique.
No, it's good. So I have to actually choose my words better, because I'm normally asking these questions almost on autopilot. So within this org, did they have growth out in the open, or is it one of those things where everybody's like, high five, yeah, we want you to grow. Good luck with that. Like, was there an environment that was conducive to it? Was it stated? Was it, you know, did it, was it celebrated? Was it aligned? All of that. Like how did that go down, or did it?
I love this question. In that company in particular, I think that there was a disconnect between the words and the actions for what they were promoting for growth from an individual basis. And I don't think it was deliberate. I think this is a really easy thing for fast growing companies to fall into. I've definitely worked with people where you look at someone, you're like, oh, they're schemy and gross. And I'm not trying to say that here. What I saw was it's so much of the growth that we went through as individuals from an individual basis came down to the extraordinary need and hunger of the organization to step up into those things. Right. But because all of us were being pulled into having to grow and stretch and do something new that had never been done before, and you have that pull, there was very little to none, depending on who you were working with, introspection about the effect of that pull and if you were getting supported as you're getting pulled. There are organizations where it is deemed distasteful to show ambition for growth. I don't think we ever had the opportunity to opt out of growth at that company at that stage. So there was no opportunity for that sort of distaste for someone to have an open hunger for growth. But the flip side of that is because it wasn't being deliberately opted into either by the org or the people, there wasn't a good reward structure for it. there, mm-hmm. and what by that I mean, there wasn't a great recognition structure for how someone had sort of fundamentally shifted themselves. There was a peer-based reward structure that was very effective for rewarding something that had happened recently, but it wasn't like you had somebody looking at you and saying, you have really stepped up, like not just stepped up in this moment, but stepped up into a new level. Not to conflate that with like engineering levels or career levels, but just generally, like, you are now a different class of badass than you were before. And it was like, right. You didn't have somebody to, the organization wasn't structured for someone to consider that, examine that, and celebrate that.
Right.
And I think that, I would be lying if I said that those experiences, there were things about that that felt really good, that were good. But there were also things about it that I think were suboptimal. And I am absolutely confident that those things, those experiences influence how we think about building our company now.
Because
there are things you want to embrace and there's things you want to explicitly not opt in for.
Yeah, definitely. So actually the next question I was going to ask, because growth and career pathing are kind of two sides of the same coin. Like, you kind of mentioned one style of growth, which is like, our company is growing like crazy. We need you to learn mm-hmm. Rust or whatever it's going to be. You know,
yeah.
Scala or Clojure or whatever, you know.
Make it scale. Yeah.
Right. Totally. But, you know, and that's kind of, that's like the most sort of normalized kind of growth, I think. There's also folks who get tired of having their job wired and they want to grow outside of their comfort zone in other ways mm-hmm. and stuff. And like you alluded to earlier, in the long haul, that ultimately vectors your career path. It's like there are two sides of the same coin in that you're not advancing in your arc if you're not growing. But growth's a little bit managed more like quarterly, and your path is your whole career, you know, your whole lifetime basically. So it sounds to me like this org didn't really put a lot into that because they are already mostly a flat org. But did you adopt it later, or were there other orgs you worked at where those two things, growth and career pathing, were really front and center to the equation?
During my time at Second Life, I was not there. If they got to where they were more deliberate in that way, it happened after I left. It totally could have. We would definitely done a lot of work together to create more structure. And I know that there were more revisits on whether the structure was working, which makes total sense. You do want to revisit these things. It's an interesting question. So I think a lot about, when we're talking about like recognition and growing your career over time, I think a lot about lagging promos versus leading promos. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yes.
So I have worked in companies where there are no promos really. That's the Second Life model. It's just like, oh, we're just all running at the same pace and we don't do titles. I'm doing air quotes, sorry. Those are some narratives we hear. And then you have the lagging promo model, which would be something that they do at like Google and Facebook and a lot of other companies,
yeah.
where you have to prove that you're already successful at a level for a period of time before you're eligible to receive the promotion officially into that level.
Yep.
And then you have the old school, I would say the sort of older version of what promotion structures looked like, which was, you're going to, congratulations, your new job is now blah, you know, which is the congratulations, you're the new boss of this team. And then you get a promotion with that before you've done the work. So it's the promotion after you've done the work versus the promotion before you've done the work.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why some companies have really embraced the lagging promo model. It is a risk-averse model. It's a risk-averse model for the company, and it's a risk-averse model for the employee, theoretically, because then they're less likely to fail out, to get promoted up and have to get kicked out, right? It should theoretically reduce the Peter principle, at least on the IC side.
Yep.
However, I don't embrace it. I just understand it. I think that for our company, for the company we have now, we have a core principle, which is that we don't underestimate ourselves and we don't underestimate each other. And to me, part of that means that you embrace that risk and you take that risk together. So I think when you're planning for somebody's growth in their career, having now done this both ways, where I've been in places where you had the leading promo and the lagging promo, I tend to go towards the leading promo because I think that it can provide greater opportunity, assuming that you don't do, what's the word I'm looking for here? Assuming that all promos are agreed upon by both parties. Like you can't just like drop a promo on someone without their permission because it has to be opt-in. Mm-hmm. But assuming that you have that, I prefer leading promos to lagging promos. I think that lagging promos can be really demoralizing and they don't showcase to somebody that you believe in them. And if you don't believe in somebody, then what are you doing? So that has been a principle that we're applying where we are. And we take that all the way down into our interview process to some extent, right? Because most interview processes are set up in a way that you're looking for reasons to say no to people, and we approach it that we are looking for reasons to say yes. And I think that's just a different, we may end up hiring exactly the same people both ways, but the way you engage is different, I think, when you have a different goal walking in the door.
Yeah, I'm on the fence about that. As far as, you know, leading or lagging, mm-hmm. it might have been just out of my own sort of greenness growing an org before or et cetera, where I had emergent leaders and emergent managers, people who got up, grabbed the whiteboard marker, started writing on the walls. They were all painted, so you could do that, right? Mm-hmm, and they lead the conversation in the room, and nobody's leaving the conference room until all of the things on the board are delegated out, and then there's action, and then a date we're going to meet again, you know. And mm-hmm. watching this kind of just emerge, I was like, oh my gosh, it's time to go from flat to structured. And at that point, I did actually promote someone who was already doing the job, but it was my fault, right? Not for anticipating it correctly.
Right.
You know, so there's a bit of growth on my own side because I've seen that happen several times now where people were basically already doing the job and then we gave it to them. But you're right. There's something to be said for, like, if you're in a bigger org, you probably have a stated ladder or a dual track ladder and you're like, you're here and here's what you need to do to advance over here on the engineering side. Or if you want a lateral over to the other side, these are the traits and things, you know, et cetera, right? So you don't usually have that structure early on in an early stage startup. Right. You'll have to have it as you're growing that. So in that case, I think it sets up sets the stage better to have, leading promotions in that regard rather than lagging.
It's funny though, because all of these cases, leading and lagging promos, both have the same challenge, which is if there isn't opportunity to step into the space and show what you can do, either leading or lagging, then there's no opportunity for that person to move up, right? And that is not my problem now, right?
It's not an early stage problem.
No, it's not an early stage problem, but it is a real problem companies face all over the place, right?
Yeah.
It's like, how do you, and then how do you equitably and effectively and how do you actively distribute those opportunities, right? Because in absence of actively distributing those opportunities, they'll tend to go to the same people over and over again by default. And so how do you deliberately distribute those opportunities is another interesting problem on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then even how do you deal with like someone who's ready to go up and you don't have that role for them, sort of like they say in the Netflix manifesto, we'd love to see you grow, even if it's not here. So we'll throw you a pizza party on the way out and give you a high five and maybe welcome you back too someday, you know?
I mean, I believe that there's only one right way to run the calculus on that as a manager, maybe even as a CEO, but I haven't had to do it yet. So at this company. Which is, you know, first you optimize for the person, for the individual person, and then you optimize for the company. And then after that, you optimize for the team and then yourself. So from that perspective, like what is best for this, what is best for this human? What is best for the company? If that means that they're leaving your team and going to another team, yes, that's what that means, right? Like, that sucks to be you, but that's what you're going to go through as a team manager, right?
Yep.
And then the last person who gets to have any sort of like sway in who this is good for is you as the manager. That's the only way I think to run that calculus. And so in that way, I would say that I probably am. There are some things in the manifesto you described that I don't super line up with, but that's one I super line up with. The idea that, you know, companies are made of people. Supporting people is the most important thing to help your company be really strong and grow. So.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of people, throughout your history, once you got into the management side, do you have any star performers or good stories, anecdotes? You don't necessarily have to mm-hmm. name them, but do you have folks who grew faster than the norm?
There are always people who grow in a different way than you expected them to. And it's not always interesting how they grew in the short term. I'm really fascinated now, looking back over the last 20 some odd years, how people have grown over the long term in ways that I would not have expected. And and discovering like how I had a small part to play in that. So this one's very much on my mind today because I had dinner earlier this week with some former colleagues from Facebook, and one of them now has joined a different company. Her peer as a director is a guy I managed at Second Life years and years ago, like 10 years ago. and of course they're like, you know, sharing stories about me because that's what you do when you first meet somebody. You share stories about who you know to who you both know. And it's fascinating and really rewarding and completely surprising to me to hear stories about things that happened, you know, 10 plus years ago and how they influenced him now as a director who has his own large organization and is managing groups of managing managers and being very, very successful and beloved of his teams. His teams love him. And he was sharing with my former Facebook colleague about how I had been really influential for him as someone who was a manager back when, like how you treat people, how you support people, how you don't take credit for yourself. Because as a manager, you're gonna get it anyway, right? Like you don't take credit for yourself, you're gonna get it anyway. You wanna make sure you get the credit to the people on your teams and he does. And how you manage up and how you prioritize and how you try to distribute opportunities. And it's fascinating to me to think, I don't know, if you had told me 10 years ago that this guy was, I always knew he was a talented and caring engineer, but that he was going to be like, you know, pretty senior in the engineering org of a very well-known public company. And then that I would have had some influence in that success. It's difficult to articulate. I think I'm still processing it. But it's definitely not something you expect. I think we think a lot about the person that we bring in. So like you bring in someone who maybe is an unusual candidate, and we certainly look a lot at distance traveled, for example, when you have somebody coming in and you give them the opportunity and they just run ahead and you see that delight and you get to delight in that as a manager in the mid and near term. You're like, oh, look, they're so good. And you feel happy about that. You see them stretch and grow. But it is fascinating now doing the manager thing and saying, oh man, like I was managing in ICs and now he's a director and he still thinks about how I helped him. And I don't know, that's really something.
Yeah, definitely. So one of my favorite questions when I meet folks, you know, at meetups and conferences or whatever, and we're sitting at the bar and maybe having a beer or something, I'm like, mm-hmm. All right, what are your imperatives? What are the things for you that are most important that you look for in the people that you hire and the people you work with, and maybe even in the types of people that your company focuses on targeting, et cetera? What is most important to you in terms of imperatives?
I'm trying to figure out how to articulate this because I want to say I'm very drawn to integrity. But that's like, that can be such a mishy-mashy word that I'm trying to find a better way to explain it because it can be used to describe so many things. I'm very drawn to someone who is at least slightly dissatisfied And what I mean by that is that when they look at something, they're like, that's good, it could be better. I, someone who isn't so down on the things that have happened to them, that they're just, everyone has our down moments, but someone who's not so far down that they can't still see, here's how it could have been better and want to make a better version of it. One of my very favorite interview questions, for example, is I always ask people, tell me something good about either where you are now or where you just were. Tell me what's great about it. And it's a little bit of a sneaky question, right? Because what I get from that is somebody's telling me what they value and what matters to them by what they're choosing to highlight. And they will also typically come up with, but that doesn't make up for, and they'll tell you all the things that they can't stand for, that they want to see improved. so that's a little bit of a sneaky question to get to it. But I loved appetite for better. And that's not the same as appetite for change. Appetite for better is a combination of, I suppose, dissatisfaction and belief that things can be better. And those are definitely things that that both my co-founder and I are really drawn to when we're talking with people to join us, and also that we continue to celebrate in the people that are already working with our company. Because they look around and they see all of the ways that this could be better, that could be better. And you do it with a ruthless customer focus, and you do it from that perspective, and you make sure you keep the lens on your customer all the time. But I think it's that the root of it, of just that combination of belief it could be better and yep. enough dissatisfaction that you're willing to take action towards that is for me probably what I actually am most attracted to in a variety of kind of people.
Yeah, one of the gems from this interview series in regards to extreme or outsized growth is this idea that you identify and solve problems that you weren't even asked to do.
Yeah.
And that rolls up to a multiplier too, right? This is in bigger orgs though, but you know, you'll see mm-hmm. where the effects of that have a huge compounding effect, because it's the opposite of going into committee. And it's mm-hmm. it's why early stage startups with the right teams can go super fast, because they're not mm-hmm. mired in all of these things, so they can achieve a lot of value early. And then as they go through the stages of growth, they start to get mired by committee. So this is like the anti-venom, or the opposite of that, the antimatter of committee, right. which is like seeing stuff and just solving it without even being asked. And so that's a great one, because you have to have an eye. It's not best practices, it's better practices, right? You need an eye for continuous improvement. Back to that again, right?
Exactly. That is a beautiful way of putting that. It's not best practices, it's better practices. You can, I mean, perfection is the enemy of good, right? It's like, we're never going to do something. We're never going to ship something if we're waiting for, and also I don't think perfect exists. Like if you are someone who, I'm all about being dissatisfied, but I'd rather have a little bit of perpetual dissatisfaction than deciding you were going to aim for some apex, and then when it was accomplished, you'd be done. I'd like to see some sort of like constant drive towards change. Yeah,
absolutely. All right. Any other driving imperatives for you? Other things that you look for in folks that you're going to work with or be with?
I made a brief mention of distance traveled, which I find is reflective of just tenacity, I think. We have been so fortunate to work with people who come from a bunch of different kinds of backgrounds into our company. And I've been fortunate to have this over my career as well. We do look at distance traveled as a factor when we're considering somebody joining us, because we find that with a longer distance traveled, we know that that person can navigate ambiguity. They can get get things done when there's no obvious path that's been pre-laid for them to do it. It's an interesting way to sort of see see, you know, writ in the fact that they're in front of you in the first place, the creativity of a person in problem solving. So that's another thing that I definitely look for. I don't think it's my imperative in that if somebody has had an easier path in their earlier life, that's not necessarily a negative. It's not going to take them out. But I do find that working with somebody who has an interesting journey on how they came to be in front of you can be really demonstrative of the kinds of ways that they think about solving problems.
Okay, quick metadata. Have you seen Mr. Robot?
Yes.
Okay.
Every week.
Okay, I'm gonna quickly share one of mine, which is if you're familiar with the White Rabbit in Mr. Robot, yes. There's this room full of clocks, and White Rabbit obsesses over time, right?
Do you mean White Rose?
Oh yeah, sorry, White Rose. I don't know why I'm thinking White Rabbit, probably Alice in Wonderland. But yeah, White Rose obsesses over everything happening on time.
Yeah.
And so for me, my biggest imperative is be the fuck on time, right? So be on time. And it's not that my time is more valuable than yours. It's the whole team and the org, et cetera. And to me, it's very instructive when a candidate misses first contact, even by like 5 minutes, that's kind of a big deal. Because you should be preparing and you should text, you know, and the people who miss first contact altogether, they don't have a chance really. But
yeah, right. It's
also in the fine details of how you do meetings and all this stuff. But in fact, some orgs actually do 25 and 55 minute meetings, you know, just so you have time to do your bio break, whatever you need to do. Between meetings.
They always run over though.
Yeah, yes, totally. But for me, that's a big one, is just everybody being on time and then the etiquette of actually truly responding and yes or no to meetings, because you see some people with triple and quadruple stacked calendars, and to me that's organizational dysfunction at that point. You know, you should really be subscribed to one thing at a time. But go ahead.
I agree with you in thinking about how you respect other people and show up in a way that demonstrates that respect for other people. But I think what my meta point on your be on time thing is, which is interesting, but it's very difficult to suss out in a candidate interaction, is my tolerance for people who are fundamentally dismissive of other people's experiences. That my tolerance for that shit's real low.
Yep.
So
yep,
if you're just like, if you assume that your time is more important than anybody else's,
yep,
either by actions or words, then I do not let that shit go.
Yep, right there with you.
That does not go by me. Because I'm like, that's not, because those are the building blocks of every interaction that happens after this, right? So
yeah, totally.
Like, we are shutting this shit down, or that one's not going to continue. But that's just my.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to head into the home stretch of the conversation now. So let's talk about my favorite, which are wild card questions. This time it's going to be about awkward interviews. So these could be either given or interviews that you've taken, et cetera, where, you know, something wasn't right about the interview or just something weird happened. I mean, the good ones are always great because, hey, I got hired, or we hired the person, or whatever it is. But I'm looking for anything. It could even be cringy. If we're going to laugh at it, let's learn from it. You know, that kind of thing. It's not just to poke fun. But what can we learn about some of your more interesting interview experiences?
So I think that I've had more of these as an interviewer than as an interviewee. My interviewee experiences have been, I mean, at times we all had kind of a crappy interview, but my interviewer ones are done more. I've interviewed more people than I've done interviews. So maybe that's why I just have more volume. There are a few things about being an interviewer that we, you know, there's all the things we want to do. We want to go in, we want to have our job to do, but everybody's going to do their work. The ones that there's one category that I think about, which is the interviewee is trying to manipulate you. And there are so many of these that fall, and I mean, like, not just like to make you think they're like a good candidate, but like literally manipulate you. And I don't know if this happens to me more because because I'm a woman, it may happen to everybody. I've only been me. I've never been another person. But there's this fascinating, I think that's the big theme I have across the worst of the ones I've had. So being on the lookout for this is probably worthwhile. The two cases that leap to mind for me on this, three cases for me leap to mind for me on this. The first one is the interviewee who is going to show you how awesome and woke they are, and how cool they think it is that there's a girl in IT, mm-hmm. and a girl is a manager in IT. And that is a quote that I've heard a couple times from people.
Yeah, that's the soft bigotry of low expectations. Yeah.
And there's so many things wrong with that sentence too. Yep, just like totally. Word, it's short sentence with so much going on, but instead of unpacking it, we'll throw out the whole suitcase. Okay. The other cases are more trying to do emotional manipulation. There was the guy who, I was interviewing for a technical operations role, like a relatively senior operations role, who told me that the reason he had left his last company is because his co-founder had committed suicide, which is a terrible thing. He had taken his own life. It was just a terrible thing.
It's terrible.
Yeah, but terrible. And he started crying in the interview, which it's not the only time I've ever had someone cry in the interview, but it is one that sticks out for me. But here's the thing. Yeah, I'm with you until this moment. And then I said, well, I, you know, I'm being, you know, trying, you want to be really sensitive to someone. I said, I understand. This is very, I totally, you know what, do you want to take a second? We'll move on. We'll talk about something else. Do you want to take a second? And he was just like, no, I'm good. And he just turned off the waterworks. It was like, what else do you want to talk about?
Whoa.
So this was so obviously like I'm going to make her feel bad for me. Anyone who's looking for a pity interview or a pity hire, I don't know. That guy gave everybody a lot of weird signals, but I think I'm the only one who got the former co-founder waterworks treatment. He got a no hire from a lot of people, not just me. The other one is the case of someone who is evading the conversation and sort of trying to do like, have you ever done media training? A media training where you go through, and if you're going to do a lot of interviews for your company, for example, you can go in and do media training with someone where they teach you if somebody how to respond in the moment. If you have a reporter who's asking you a question and it's a question you can't answer, you're uncomfortable, and they sort of
So I'm a comms person, and I love communication and criticism, so I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I've never taken it, but I look for it though.
Yeah, so I've had to take this in various companies at various times, you know, it's one of the conditions. Anyway, so being on the receiving end of somebody who's trying to media train you on an interview leads to some fascinating interplay. There was a guy who, every time I tried to ask him a technical question, just kept trying to talk to me about his wife and his kids. And it's that same thing. It's trying to manipulate the interviewer into being like, oh, what a nice guy, I like this guy, but not actually giving me any of the data that I needed.
It's all ethos and no logic, right?
Yeah, and the goal there, of course, is that he thinks that he's going to, in the case I'm specifically thinking about, he obviously thought that he was going to just be, he was going to connect with me. Do you know what I mean? And
yeah,
I'm like, answer my damn question. Like, I'm asking you actual questions,
right?
And instead you're like, well, you know, I just love, you know, I think it's so great, and you know, my wife is, you know, before she had our kids, she, you know, she went to blah 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 and got her degree, and that, I'm like, I'm happy for her, and answer a damn question, you know. It just, right. those are really difficult.
Maybe at the end or near the offer stage you're interested in those kinds of things, but yeah, I'm with you.
but of course the goal was always just to, well, the thing that was particularly funny about that one, I think I've told this story in public before. So the one I'm thinking of at this moment is a guy that I interviewed for an engineering leadership role at Second Life. And I interviewed him. One of our VP that we had, who is a woman, interviewed him. She was in a different part of the company, but she interviewed him as well. And we both walked out and we're like, this guy is slippery. He is not going to answer any questions. We need to get him out. We're not going to put anybody else through this. But we told him he was going to talk to at least three people. So let's drop someone else on him.
Oh, no.
So we can like, yeah. So because, you know, you also want to treat candidates relatively well. It's a dance, right? So what we did is we picked this new guy, brand new guy, had just started at the company. Super nice guy. We pick Rob and we're like, hey, go interview this guy. You can't possibly mess it up. There's no risk to you. You wanted to test out. You wanted to practice interviewing.
That's right. Sea trials.
Free dress rehearsal. Just go in there. We promise nothing that happens in there is going to be bad for you in any way. Go for it. And he's like nervous because he has no prep. And
we're
like, it's going to be fine. Just go in there. It's
gonna go be talk great. To him. Yeah.
Just go talk to him. And then we'll walk him out afterwards. We've decided just go in there and be great. So the guy goes in there. Oh my gosh, I'll never forget the look on his face. He goes in there, he talks to the guy for half an hour or whatever. He comes out and he has this look of horror on his face, just like abject horror. And he says, I told the guy that I was a PM, and I think I was a director, and then the other woman that he talked to was a VP. He's like, I told the guy that I was a PM, and I told him I'd only been here for a week. And still he said, thank God I get to talk to someone who actually knows what's going on around here.
Oh no.
and the guy who's, you know, our colleague who was the one who had taken the hit to go in and do the interview is just, you know, the woman who had also done the interview and I, we're like legit scary people, you know? And so for him, he has to come out and tell us that this thing just happened. And we were just like, oh, we are so sorry that happened to you. You did fine. We know it wasn't you. Just go on. You're fine. But I think that there is that there's lots of different ways that the candidates can try to emotionally manipulate you, but that one is and that one is stand out specifically because of the look on that guy's face. Out of the room. Burned, you know, in my memory.
That reminds me of a story from my last company. We were growing so fast at a period of time. We were just always on calls, first contact. We were always having on-sites. Mm-hmm. And we got to the point where we would have people interview people on their first day. And that sounds ridiculous, but, and they'll tell the candidate that too. It's just that they're really good at whatever it is, you know, that they're good at. Mm-hmm. And we still respect their opinion and they still get a vote as a team, et cetera. So it's like, that's actually a badge of honor. It's actually quick, really, really, really quick growth. And I think there were probably five alum from VideoAmp where I was at. That are even still there that did that to somebody else. Like, oh, I interviewed you on my first day. You know, it's like becomes part of the cultural, you know, part of the history, you know?
Yeah. Kind of thing. Yeah.
Cool. Totally. Any other interview type stories that you have to maybe share?
You know, you always have the weird interviews where you go into someone and the interviewer is fundamentally unprepared. But those have tended to range. There was one time that I helped somebody assemble their desk.
I've heard this one before.
But it happens, right? Somebody's got to assemble your desk, their desk. You're like, look, I can help you do that while we're talking. It's fine, you know. I would much rather be as an interviewee helping someone assemble a desk than trying to do some sort of ridiculous whiteboard coding interview if I'm coming in as a senior engineering director, right?
Because
what are you really testing me for? What do you really want? You want problem solving? Let's get some IKEA going. That'll show you some problem solving, right?
Hey, it's better than like VoigtConf, you know, if you're into Blade Runner, you know, the VoigtConf test.
Oh,
you
know, yes.
goes for 8 hours, I think, you know.
Oh my gosh. Yes, absolutely.
That's actually, absolutely. I jokingly equate that to hiring more senior engineering management, because with like tech stuff, it's a little more objective, but to kind of tease out like, what are your soft skills? What are your imperatives? Again, that's actually one of my favorite interview questions. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a little more like VoigtConf actually when interviewing senior, you know, executives, management, et cetera.
I mean, interviewing and hiring for senior executives and management is so different. Again, managing, but also interviewing is completely different than I see, is because, you know, and there's so much risk aversion there because you don't want to bring in the wrong person and they can do a lot of damage. And yes, all of these things are true. But also, I think often when people are starting to interview when we're interviewing for tech roles, we have a better idea of what we're looking for. I think we want someone who either has already solved a problem or has demonstrated by their growth that they have the capacity to figure out how to solve a problem, depending on where you are and how you hire people and what your role is. For executives, I think we almost never do that sort of really thoughtful introspection on ourselves of what we want that person to be.
Yep.
You know, we can look at the hole in the org chart and say, oh, we want somebody to be our new VP of engineering or a new CTO, even depending on where you are, or whatever. But what are the things that are the skills, not just the activities, but the skills of that person, right? Because activities are kind of easier to bench on. Skills are harder. And I think we don't do a good job generally when we're preparing to grow our companies to be ready to do that. And then you end up with a whole, like, I'll know it when I see it thing.
Right, right.
And then that's terrible.
I went through that. At VideoAmp, I was a co-founder CTO, and I was there 5 years. And then I hired my replacement before I went on the sabbatical. And mm-hmm. we used an executive recruiting firm, and we took a year to run the process. I actually mm-hmm. ran 6 months of my own process beforehand. And I interviewed about probably six people out of the LA area. And mm-hmm. they got to a point where I thought I found the one. And there were so many good folks. But I have to admit, I was a little bit in over my head. This is the biggest company I had built to date. And mm-hmm. it kind of, with a lot of startup founders, the companies can often eclipse them, right? If it's successful.
Oh, yeah.
And this one definitely is, you know. And so when it got to like interviewing folks that are actually, they have me covered on a lot of dimensions in terms of experience and philosophies. And I'm like, holy crap, like these folks are really, really good. And I got this sort of analysis paralysis quandary you're talking about. Like, how do I choose? And it wasn't just me, right? We had an executive mm-hmm. recruiting firm when we brought it in for the second half of the process did make it easier because they too are dealing with sort of VIP or white glove kind of treatments, but with both the candidates and the companies. And that helped to an extent. But yeah, actually, for us, I just came to the conclusion that I had talked to probably 7 or 8 amazing candidates, but we had to close on who knew our domain better than anybody else. And that's like mm-hmm. television and video ad tech and all this stuff. But yeah, actually, it does get harder and harder to interview folks at or above your level, I would say.
Oh, yeah. Hiring someone and then supporting someone who is in some dimension more senior than you, I think is one of the hardest things to do in any management.
Well, all right, Bethany, thanks so much for joining today. It's been a great conversation, and what a really cool story you have in your career arc and a lot of gems in there. I'm really, really looking forward to our next discussion, maybe even off the record, maybe over a beer or something, but thanks again for joining.
Thanks. It's been great fun.